You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Brian Callen Show with not Brian Callen, Hunter Motz. Brian is off. I mean, you know, it's just when there's only one Brian Callen and 7 billion humans, inevitably it's hard to get him in any one room because so many people want a piece of him. But we will be doing mixed mental arts today on the show and with a guest that many of you have requested for a very long time, Peter Schiff. Peter, you've kind of done it all. I mean, tell us a little bit about, you know, what it's like being, you know, a rich, you know, guy who also goes into politics and, you know, you're a handsome man. And I don't mean that in a sexual way, just in a purely aesthetic way.
Well, look, you know, I mean, I'm no Donald Trump. I mean, you know, I ran for Senate once and I lost, right? And so he ran for president and won. He obviously has a lot more money than I do. But I haven't done it all. I've done a few things, but I, you know, I have achieved, you know, a modicum of success. You know, I was on a plane yesterday. Two people recognized me. So, you know.
Wow. Well, that's good. That's good.
So there's always, you know, whenever I get into, you know, a situation where there's a lot of people, usually somebody will recognize me. But, you know, but there has to be a lot of people there. You know, it can't just be like a small, you know.
But as an investor, you understand you have to diversify your portfolio. You have to have a wide range of humans to get a hit, right?
Well, I mean, in my business, I mean, because I deal in retail. I mean, I guess if you're, you know, the hedge fund, you can have a small number of clients because they all give you lots of money.
Right.
But I have a lot of clients that give me a small amount of money. So, so I need a lot of them. I'm dealing with regular investors. You know, I'm not, you know, dealing with the, you know, the elite, just guys that, you know, I mean, obviously most Americans, the average American can't be a client because the average American is broke. So just to have an account with me means, you know, you're not the typical American because you actually have savings. You actually have something that you haven't spent everything that you earned. But, you know, my clients are more typical high net worth investors than, you know, the ultra rich.
So let's talk about, yeah, in terms of, you know, a lot of Americans, the American dream isn't working for them. And, you know, that I think was part of what prompted your Senate run. So why don't we talk about what motivated you to run for the Senate?
Well, you know, now you're talking about 6 years ago, and basically at the time, it was relatively soon after the financial crisis, the Peter Schiff was right video. You know, I had been associated with the Ron Paul campaign in 2008 as an economic advisor, so I developed a pretty good following, and it was a lot of the people that were following me online. I mean, they basically had a draft Peter Schiff campaign, and part of the initial appeal was that the Senate seat belonged to Chris Dodd, and he was, you know, one of the architects of the housing bubble, and so it seemed only fitting that I try to run against Chris Dodd. But, you know, Chris dropped out, so he wasn't even going to be my opponent, even if I managed to get the nomination, which I didn't. I ended up losing to Linda McMahon, who was able to spend significantly beyond what I was prepared to pay. I mean, I actually raised a couple, you know, $2.5 million from individual donors, but then I kicked in about $1 million of my own money. But she spent $30 million of her own money, and there's just no way to overcome that. But I did a lot better than people thought. I mean, you look at the polls, talk about the Donald Trump polls. Like the week before the election, I was polling at like 4 or 5%, and I got 23%, and it was a three-way race. So it was, you know, it wasn't like it was a two-person race. I would have got a lot more if it was a two-person race. But I think too, a lot of people didn't vote for me because they thought I had no chance because
right.
The polls were just so low on me. But the polls were completely wrong. I mean, they totally underestimated the support I had. And you know, the other candidate was a lifelong congressman, very well known in Connecticut, Republican. So I ran against an insider who had high name recognition, was endorsed by like all the newspapers except one that endorsed Linda. But he was the establishment Republican, well known. And then there was Lynn McMahon, who just spent a fortune. So everybody knew her. And then me, I was the third guy. No, I still did a lot better than what people thought I was going to do, and I think I could have won, theoretically, if I had gotten some coverage, if people actually took my campaign seriously. In fact, you can see the original debate. I actually put it up again on my YouTube channel. If you go to, you know, the Schiff Report, you can look at the debate. The only debate I did, it was me, Linda McMahon, and Rob Simmons. It was so early in the campaign that not a lot of people were paying attention. But I did so well in the campaign, in the debate, that Linda would never debate me again. So we never got to do another one. She just refused. So,
well, that's, you know, that is, that's good. I mean, but the, let's talk about the 2008 housing crisis, because what I part, you know, we recently had Kathy O'Neill on, who wrote this book, Weapons of Math Destruction, which is a great book. And I think what's interesting is, you know, for, I think the classic book on any sort of housing bubble or any sort of financial folly is This Time is Different. And, you know, whatever the justifications or whatever the rationalizations are, it's always that fundamental psychology that sets in where everybody convinces themselves that they just can't lose. And the difference in 2008 was that it was rationalized with so much fancy math, and there was all these mathematical justifications for why housing prices could never go down. But, you know, a lot of what drives, you know, the psychology of investing is obviously psychology. It's human psychology. So, you know, and I think that gets to, you know, sort of your beef with a lot of sort of classical economics, right?
Well, I mean, certainly you get, you know, the people believe in things when there's a crowd and everybody, you know, reinforces their own beliefs, and, you know, you have the market going in your way, which only emboldens you that you're right. But yeah, during the housing bubble, I mean, I was, you know, I had so many arguments with so many people for so many years over the absurdity of what I was seeing.
Mm-hmm.
And but yeah, I mean, nobody would acknowledge it, but it was so obvious to me. I mean, and you can look at what I was writing from, particularly from 2004 to 2007. I wrote extensive articles online that I published that I sent to hundreds of reporters, going over the housing bubble and how Greenspan was inflating it and what the Fed was doing wrong and what the consequences were going to be. I mean, right down to the bankruptcy of Fannie and Freddie. I mean, I went into all the jingle mail. I wrote, you know, that people were going to be walking away from their houses and stripping out the plumbing and leaving the, you know, all the things that ultimately happened in 08 and 09. I mean, this is what I was writing about it all, you know, in 04, 05. This is what's going to happen. This is the consequence of it.
Yeah.
And then you can see, you know, when I went in 2005, I spoke on a panel of experts at the Western Regional Mortgage Bankers Conference, and I told everybody about the housing bubble. And, you know, of course, by then, no one even thought that there was even an inkling of a problem. But they invited me back a year later because they started to see some of my predictions starting to come true. And that's the speech that I have on my YouTube channel, Peter Schiff Mortgage Bankers. But the only reason I went there was I was looking for clients to invest in my hedge fund, the short, the subprime mortgage market, which imploded the following year. And, you know, out of 3,000 people, one person sent me his money. You know, he made about 10 times what he invested in less than a year because he got into my fund. But none of these people could even see it. I laid it out clearly what the problem was, and you can see it in that speech. But what I don't have is my workshop. I did a workshop after that speech, and I went into the exact mechanics of the trade. You know, this became, you know, the Big Short, you know, the trade. They based the movie on it. I went in, look, this is what you do. This is how I'm doing it. This is why it's going to work. You know, I handed that trade to, you know, to all these guys. They were in the mortgage business, and they still couldn't see it. They still couldn't, you know, understand what I said. This is inevitable. This is going to happen. So it is, you know, like the popular delusions and the madness of crowds. And it sets in, and it kind of clouds people's judgment. And the same thing is going on now. I mean, we have got bigger economic problems now. The U.S. economy is much more screwed up today than it was on the eve of the financial crisis in 08. I mean, no question about it. I mean, what the Federal Reserve has done this time around is far more reckless than what inflated the housing bubble. And the distortions in the economy, the misallocations and malinvestments, are on an order of magnitude larger today than they were in 2007. So we are on the precipice of something much worse. But of course, the same people that were blindsided back then are equally blinded now. And just like, you know, that last time, they're like, well, nobody could have seen this coming. Nobody could have predicted this. You know, they're going to say the same thing again. You know, but, you know, it's very easy to predict if you understand it. It's what's impossible to predict is the timing. I mean, that's, you know, no one knows when it's going to happen, you know. But you just know that it's going to happen. Like, just, I didn't know, you know, when the dot-com bubble would burst either, but I just knew that it would, and then it did. I did the same thing with the housing bubble. What we've got now is those two bubbles combined and then, like, squared.
But I think that's the interesting question is it's, you know, this sort of behavior is very obvious to certain people and totally, you know, they are going to be blindsided again. But that is fundamentally because they're just not very emotionally aware. And so they end up being driven by emotions of which they're not even aware. Like you can't be aware of your own psychology and the degree to which your mind is playing tricks on you and convincing you that you can't lose if you're not even really aware of how your own mind works.
Yeah, well, I mean, and people just, you know, they have their own vested interests in perpetuating something or a narrative, and they develop a case of cognitive dissonance where, you know, they just, you know, anything that tries to conflict with what they believe is just immediately rejected, you know, and they find a way to rationalize it.
Exactly. You know? And I mean, that's, you know, a large part of what we've sort of come to on this show is there's a, you know, Antonio Damasio, who's at USC, has this thing, Descartes' error, which is that a very long time ago, Descartes came up with this idea that reason and emotion were separate. And, you know, there's an experiment that I can talk you through. But essentially, the conclusion of, you know, Kahneman and Tversky and John Haidt and all of these other guys is that thinking and feeling are always linked. It's just that you're not always aware of the feelings that are driving your own thinking. And, you know, there's a process of becoming aware of, oh, this is how my brain actually works. This is how my feelings drive my thinking. And the point is that I think that if we're trying to understand why is it that you see these things clearly and most people don't, it's because you're much more emotionally and psychologically self-aware than a lot of the people on Wall Street.
Yeah. And, of course, people try to make the argument in reverse about me. Oh, Peter, you're just a gloom and doomer. You're just a perma-bear.
Yeah.
So you're just always bearish, and so you're never going to accept this. And what they don't understand is that the reason that I'm still bearish, you know, like I was bearish then, right, and now I'm still bearish. So they say, oh, you're a perma-bear. Well, it's not that I'm a perma-bear. It's just that what the problems that existed that caused me to be bearish back then have not only not been solved, they've been exacerbated.
Right.
So why wouldn't I still be bearish? But they want to act as if, well, the stock market rally, you know, proves me wrong or the real. No, it doesn't. The fact that they've managed to reflate the bubbles that popped before doesn't mean that they're not bubbles, and it doesn't mean that the underlying economic problems haven't gotten worse. In fact, if anything, look, the election of Donald Trump vindicates to a large degree what I've been saying all along about this recovery, because I was one of the few people out there that not only wasn't surprised that Donald Trump won, but I expected him to win. I mean, I didn't think it was a sure thing, but I thought that, you know, he had better than a 50-50 shot at winning. And the only thing that made me question my idea initially that he was going to win for sure was the poll. He was so far behind in the polls. But again, you know, obviously, you know, the polls weren't picking this up. But I knew that the economy was awful, and I knew that Donald Trump was going to strike a chord and was going to get a lot of blue-collar workers, union guys that normally vote Democrat to vote for him because they wanted change. They didn't want more of the same. If the economy was as good as everybody on Wall Street believes, as the Fed keeps pretending, then people would have voted for Hillary. They would have rejected Donald Trump. The reason that people were overlooking all of the obvious problems with Donald Trump that the media was like pounding in is people said, you know what? I don't care if he's a sexist or a misogynist or a homophobe or a racist or whatever they want. I don't care. I just know that I need a job.
Right.
And Hillary's not going to help me, and Donald Trump might. And so things are really bad because I lost my job, and now I've hobbled together three part-time jobs, and the president is taking credit for these jobs that have been created. I don't want these lousy jobs. I want my one good job back. I don't want these three crappy part-time jobs. But, you know, the president, every time he destroys a full-time job and then you have to get two or three part-time jobs, he takes credit for the extra jobs, right? But I knew that these discouraged people were going to, you know, vote Trump, you know, either out of protest or because they legitimately thought, you know, what the hell, let me take a shot. You know, it can't get any worse. And Wall Street was surprised by the election because they didn't realize how bad things were. But now, of course, all the people on Wall Street that were telling us what a disaster it would be for the market if Trump won, now they're like, oh, this is great, Trump won, buy stocks, right? They're the perma bulls, right? They always want to be bullish no matter what. But the reality is, Trump won the election because there are serious problems in the economy that Wall Street wants to ignore. Those problems haven't been solved, nor are they going to be solved by electing Donald Trump. The problems that got him elected are going to get worse while he's president. So nothing has changed because he's president. No. But it does confirm what I've been saying, that this recovery has been phony the whole time.
Well, of course, and I think that's the thing, is that you're seeing the same, it's the same psychology that's playing out again and again, which is there's an overfaith in the numbers from polls because they just worship in numbers and don't ever really question, are the assumptions of these numbers good? Is this data any good? And then the same thing with their models. So they're constantly sort of lost in a fog of their own mathematics, which reassures them into believing that they see the world as it really is, when really it's just a rationalizations of the feelings that they like, right? And I think the thing is, you know, for Trump particularly, because, you know, my mother's family is from Kansas, and, you know, Trump told this very simple, trackable narrative, which is that there were 1,000 jobs in your town, those 1,000 jobs went to China, and those 1,000 jobs will come back. But, you know, what's happening are much larger forces that are, you know, we're looking at structural unemployment based on automation and robotics, and a lot of those jobs are just never going to come back, and they're going to ultimately be automated out of existence, and people fundamentally need to change into totally new sectors.
Yeah, but what people also have to understand is that automation has never been a problem. You know, labor-saving devices have increased our standard of living. I mean, that's, you know, that's the progress. I mean, you know, the old joke was, you know, I forget who was watching people dig out a hole, and you look at a bulldozer and you think, or an excavator, you know, look, how many men with shovels does that machine, you know, put out of work, right? Well, how many shovels, when men were digging with their bare hands? I mean, the shovel destroyed jobs when people dug with their bare hands, you know, but the whole idea is as we become more productive, as we require fewer people to produce more stuff collectively, our standard of living goes up. I mean, if eventually we can have robots do everything, then we wouldn't have to do anything, and we would all just be living a life of leisure. You know, so it's not a bad thing that we have progress, that we find ways to produce more with less work. So this is nothing new. This has been going on since the dawn of time. I mean, you think when they first invented the wheel, how many men did that put out of work, right? Because now, you know, you can roll something much easier. Maybe one man can roll something, whereas before you needed 10 men to push it until they come up with a wheel or something like that. But this, you know, as labor is freed up from having to do mundane tasks, now that labor can be put to work doing something else that the machine can't do, you know, and then we get more and more stuff. And that's, so this is all progress. None of this is bad. But, you know, you always have people trying to argue against it. I mean, I'm sure, you know, there were people when they invented the automobiles that, oh, we can't, this is going to be terrible. Look at all the people manufacturing, you know, buggies and buggy whips, and we're all going to be out of work. Yeah, of course, you know, but look at all the people that then went to work making cars. And so people are always going to do other things, more productive things. It's not technology or progress that's the enemy. It's government. It's regulation. It's things that inhibit the free flow of capital. It's preventing people from getting retrained into new jobs and are stifling opportunity. If the government just got out of the way and we roll back or eliminate all these regulations and all these taxes and just let the free market absorb the full benefit of what's happening, then, you know, then people would not be as concerned about this.
Well, I think let's pick that apart. That's a good thing to pick apart for the next 20, 30 minutes. So the first thing is you're not talking to a Luddite. You're not talking to someone who hates technology or wants to stop technology. You're also not talking to someone who doesn't understand the benefits of creative destruction. We're all for creative destruction, and we think it's great. And yes, that creative destruction has been happening for a very long time. And the point is that in general, people have been able to shift into new industries. You know, obviously, that is what the Luddites ended up doing. You know, John Henry, he fought against the machines and he tried to outpace it and he ended up dying. And the reality is that, you know, that's what you need to do, is you need to shift industry. But at the same time, you know, we're reaching, you know, I think we're not just reaching the, you know, we're not in the beginning of the information age only, we're also in the end of the industrial age. And we're reaching the end of routine work. That's been happening since the 1970s. You can read Martin Ford's Rise of the Robots or, you know, the Second Machine Age. So it's a fundamentally new age. And the point is that if you're someone like my uncles in Kansas City, they know how to sell routine work. That's what they do. They do sort of routine operations, which are skills. And skills are fundamentally what robots and automation do best. And that's why particularly robots and automation like middle-class jobs, because those are high-skill jobs which are, involve a lot of routine. They're ideal for automation. So the reality is that, yes, absolutely, progress is great, but there is a cultural transition that needs to happen for people who have industrial-age culture, and they need to switch into information-age culture. And while it's great to think that, oh, you know, we're going to remove, regulation and that's going to solve it, that's not – it's actually – fundamentally not a problem that is in the government's hands. You know, the process
Well, no, the government does make it much more difficult to hire people, train people, because it artificially increases the cost of labor and, you know, and especially to, you know, to train people. And it, of course, there's all sorts of litigation exposure that people have when they hire people. So you, the government has created incentives to try to, you know, minimize the number of people that actually work for you. So companies are always trying to figure out how not to hire people. But absent the government, you know, disincentives to hire people, that wouldn't be the case. I mean, if it's more efficient to hire a human being, then people would do it. But they go out of their way not to. Because of government. You know, there's a lot. I mean, look at all the, you know, people, secretaries pretty much. I mean, everybody used to need secretaries. Now, most, you know, guys in business, they can do it themselves. They don't need someone to take dictation. They don't need someone to type a letter or sit there and take shorthand. They just have a computer or a smartphone. Well, right? But so, the you know, the, all those secretaries aren't there, but now we have people programming the computers.
Well, we've got all these guys on Wall Street who sort of endlessly rationalize their own feelings. I mean, that's a part of being human. And that's obviously a danger for both you and I on this call is that we have feelings that we just endlessly rationalize. So let's talk about what those feelings are and see whether our conclusions are very good. So first up, let's talk about human nature, right? You're talking about human beings and what human beings are good at. And if you look at the science, what the science says is if you give an IQ test to a chimp, a human toddler, and an orangutan on causal reasoning, the ability to figure out why things happen, we're actually no better than a chimp or an orangutan. Our great strength is social intelligence. It's the ability to talk back and forth ideas and test them. And so, for example, you know, you're going to find out that I think that the libertarian worldview, which is obviously that one you strongly believe in, is not one that holds much weight in the broad light of scientific evidence.
Well, I don't know. What evidence do you have that disproves that, you know, that freedom works and that
no somehow. I'm again like, let's, you know, I'm not a Luddite. I'm all in favor of creative destruction, and I'm not against freedom. I love freedom, but the point is that there are other parts of the equation. So let's talk about what does it take to change a person's beliefs. So for example, I am in this conversation going to try and change your beliefs, and you're going to try and change
my belief about what?
Well, your beliefs about, you know, the idea that the government is fundamentally the problem, whereas I believe that the problem is fundamentally the culture, and that the culture is the biggest piece that needs to change. So, you know,
the government is in a way a reflection of the culture of you. I mean, people are voting for all this nonsense. You know, people don't know any better, and they vote for these programs. I mean, look at all the widespread support there is for the minimum wage, and we're raising the minimum wage. I mean, that's obviously a huge problem. But the people who support increasing the minimum wage don't understand that they are creating a problem, that they are hurting the very people that they are intending to help. And so, you know, obviously there's a cultural element of that, but it's ultimately the government that is the mechanism for enforcing that destructive law.
But as you're saying, the government is just a mirror for the people. So you get the wisdom of crowds if the crowd is made up of wise individuals, and you get the foolishness or the madness of crowds if the crowd is made up of foolish or mad individuals. So ultimately, you know, in a democracy, who can you blame? Well, power rests with the people, and if you want to blame someone, you've got to blame the people. But a lot of this...
although, I mean, you know, again, you could look at the core. We know we shouldn't even be a democracy. You know, I like the fact that they're now talking about the fact that the Electoral College is supposed to be a deliberative body and not just a rubber stamp, and they don't have to elect Donald Trump, which they don't, and they don't have to elect Hillary Clinton. They can elect somebody that they can decide who they want to be president. That was the whole point of the Electoral College. It was that the average voter is too dumb to elect the president himself. So let's vote for people who are smarter than we are, and let them decide who should be president. I mean, that was the nature of the republic. I mean, that's why, you know, the senators were appointed by the state legislatures. That's why in the early days of the republic, you know, you had to be male and 21 to vote. You had to own property, or you had to have pass a literacy test or pay a poll tax. The founding fathers didn't want everybody voting because they understood if everybody did vote, we'd get bad government. the only way to get good government is to limit the people who are voting. So you don't get the crowds doing crazy things, which is what, unfortunately, we have to deal with now.
Well, the Founding Fathers, I mean, if you really want to unpack this, the Founding Fathers were aristocrats. They believed fundamentally that people like them were capable of making decisions and that the majority of people were not capable of making those decisions.
Now, well, making not certain, see, of the ability to make their own decisions and how to run their own lives, just not how to run other people's lives. So it's like today, like the theory is the average person is too dumb to make his own life choices, right? The government has to protect everybody from themselves. So the government has to come out and regulate everything that we do in our lives because we're too stupid to make our own choices because, you know, we're just going to be, some businessman is going to take advantage of us because we're all idiots. And so the government has to protect us even from ourselves and legislate every choice that we make. But we're so smart that we should be voting for president and senator. And, you know, I look at it the other way. I think that the average person should be left to make choices for himself. I trust individuals to make better choices for themselves than third parties, you know, and better choices for their own children. But I don't want the average American telling me what to do. That's the big difference. I want people to be able to live their own lives, but not try to live mine. But today, the modern liberal theory is you can't live your own life, but you tell everybody else how to live theirs. I mean, that's ridiculous.
Well, I mean, you know, I think that fundamentally both the liberal and the conservative narratives as they are currently are terrible. I wouldn't agree necessarily with the libertarian narrative because I think that if you read what Adam Smith actually wrote, you know, he was basically – Adam Smith did not invent capitalism. He just observed a phenomenon that had already appeared in human societies, which was markets. And he said these markets do a great job of allocating resources, much better than a mercantilist system. So,
yeah, but, I mean, he was just the founder of economics. He basically codified, you know, what was happening into these principles that became economics. But he was able to understand the invisible hand and the efficiencies of markets and how people working independently in their own self-interest, you know, that is the best way to increase the living standards of everybody.
He was able to understand evolution. I mean, there's a reason why markets and money and all these sorts of things evolve independently as solutions in different societies, because they're good, elegant solutions. And so he had observed an evolutionary phenomenon, and he had said, you know, the invisible hand is the same as Dawkins's blind watchmaker or any of these other things. If you allow individuals to compete and have all of these things, then ultimately they can develop solutions that are far better than any one person trying to make decisions for everyone. But at the same time, you know, we have structure that incentivizes the right sort of behavior. So if you go to a market in Cambodia or a market in, you know, Ghana or a market in Peru, there are rules to the market. You know, there are things, there are ways that you can set up stands, there are property rights, there are all sorts of, there are parameters that are created that unleash the creativity and the productivity of the market. So I think the point is that, you know, I don't know where particularly you stand, but sometimes there is this group of, there's anarcho-capitalists who try and promote this idea that we're just going to have no rules and that's how we're going to get the maximum benefit. And I think that that's utterly absurd in the light of history. So the question is, you know, I would 100% agree with you over regulation. I think Hernando de Soto's book, The Other Path, is absolutely spot on. Like, regulation can hurt the market, but the question is, where does that fine line lie of what is the Goldilocks principle of how much market regulation you should have?
Yeah, well, I think the market is the best regulator of business activity, and individual entrepreneurs, you know, want to preserve their, you know, their reputation, their brand. I mean, they want to do a good job for their customers. They want to grow the value, and they want to get richer. So they have to constantly find a way to deliver value. They have to, you know, they're in competition, and they have to get the highest quality and the lowest price. But the only real rules I think that need to exist have to do with, you know, just people stealing from other people or embezzling from other people or defrauding other people, so that you can't, you know, these are crimes. And, you know, so you have laws that regulate criminal behavior. But other than that, you know, I mean, you know, what the government does now and all the way they try to micromanage every business and every decision that a businessman makes. I mean, look, you know, like to say, oh, you got to have all these labels on your products. Well, look, if the consumer wants labels, then let him buy the products that have labels. If he couldn't care less what's in the products, then, you know, then he doesn't care. But, you know, the people that are health conscious, that want to make sure they eat healthy foods, they won't buy a food unless there's a label on it. You know, let the market decide. you know, what is going to be produced. I mean, look at all the drugs. I mean, you know, let people decide. They say, okay, well, you know, let doctors and patients decide if they want to take a chance on a new drug. I mean, why should the government, you know, have people dying when there's a drug that might cure them, but they're being prohibited from using it because they haven't gone through billions of dollars worth of efficacy tests by the FDA. I mean, there's all kinds of things. You know, people can make decisions on their own without having the government having to make all these decisions.
Well, but the thing is that, I mean, you know, if we go back to why the FDA was founded, I don't know how much you know about Radiothor.
I don't.
Well, that was sort of the big case that, you know, led to the founding of the FDA. So, you know, inevitably what happens is that any sort of new physics is discovered and people get very excited about its ability to do magical things. So there was this whole radium craze that developed in the 20s and 30s where people would drink irradiated water. They were drinking radioactive water. And they marketed it as eternal sunshine and all of this sort of stuff. And there was this guy named Eben Byers who basically hit his arm in his arm and then was prescribed by his doctor Radiothor, and he started drinking this water, and his doctor had a financial incentive to sell it because his doctor was getting a kickback, and you know, he ended up dying, and he was so radioactive at his death that he needed to be buried in a lead-lined coffin.
Yeah, and so that might have been the catalyst for the FDA, but it's always, you know, the camel's nose under the tent. You know, whenever this happens, look, I'm in the financial industry. You know, we have all these rules and regulations, you know, to theoretically protect the customer from the unscrupulous acts of brokers who would take advantage of them. Well, the reality is that in a free market, yes, there are going to be some rogue brokers and they're going to do bad things and people are going to be scammed out of money. But because of the cost of compliance with all these regulations, everybody loses much more. I mean, the you know, there's billions of dollars in extra costs to staying in business, all of which has to be borne by the consumer. So the consumers end up losing a lot more money because of the regulations than they ever would have lost from theft or bad actors of rogue brokers. I mean, that's tiny compared to the massive cost of protecting consumers. You know, I just look, you know, allow consumers to make their own choices. You know, look for companies like, look, you know, you have people out there, consumer reports. They write up reports about products, third parties. Hey, this we tested this one. Automobiles. They always, you know, test the cars. Hey, this is a good, you know, people, you know, you don't have to be an auto mechanic. You can, there's plenty of people you can find out which car, you know, but then you get the government involved, like in the banking system where the government guarantees all the bank accounts and then no one gives a damn, right? No one cares which bank is safe, which bank is risky. You just put your money in whatever bank is closest to you. You don't look at anything. You don't give a damn because the government has corrupted the market. But, you know, people shop around. You know, when people want to buy a new television set, they do their research. They find out which one is, you know, lasts the longest, which one has the fewest problems, best value. I mean, consumers do a pretty good job when it comes to spending their own money and making sure they're not getting ripped off, you know? Yeah, once in a while, somebody does get ripped off. Well, that's it. That's life, right? That's going to happen. But when the government tries to stop that from happening, it's much worse because it costs a fortune. It runs up the cost of doing everything. And now people who wouldn't have been ripped off are ripped off by the government instead.
Well, and that's the point. Again, I'm not, this is, you're talking to someone who loves the market, loves the free market, and, you know, understands that you can have too many laws, right? But that there is this Goldilocks principle. I mean, if we talk about the murder theft sort of paradigm, right? And in an evolutionary system, you're going to get people who are going to use that as a strategy to get ahead. But the reason why anarcho-capitalism is so ridiculous is because a lot of how progress has worked is that we've decided, okay, there are going to be these checks. There are going to be certain kinds of behavior that our society will not accept. And it's like rules in a soccer game. You have, like, there are things you can't do on a soccer field. I cannot bring an AK-47 onto a soccer field and just shoot the other 11 players, right? I mean, would that allow me to win? Yes, but it's fundamentally not going to make for a very good game. So in the same way, there are moves that you take off the table or that you try and police because there is, you know, parasitic behavior is an inevitable response in an evolutionary system.
But you look, it's like, I give the example of the brokerage industry. I mean, what happened too in my industry is that it's now so expensive that the minimums are getting higher and higher. So a lot of times in order to have an account, you need $50,000 minimum, you need $100,000 minimum. And that, you know, so the average American, if he has, you know, $5,000 or $10,000 to invest, can't even deal with a professional. Nobody will work with these people because it's too expensive. So now they're ripe to be scammed by a fraudster. because the only people that will work with that small an investor in many cases are people who are going to rip them off, because the honest, legitimate financial advisors cannot afford to service those small accounts because it's too expensive, because they comply with all the rules and regulations. So the only ones that don't comply with the rules and regulations are the rogue brokers. And so now the small investor is far more likely to be victimized by a rogue broker because of regulation. If we didn't have all these regulations, then the legitimate advisors could work with these people. But they can't now. The government has basically made it so expensive to work with small investors that no legitimate person can. So either you do it all yourself or you get ripped off. I mean, so the government has created a situation, you know, which is, you know, much worse than whatever they were trying to solve by coming up with the SEC and FINRA and all these organizations that are meant to help the retail broker. What's happened is now the retail broker has no help, and now they're free to be victimized.
Well, and that's the thing. I 100% agree. Like, it has gone too far in one direction. But
that's the nature of government. I mean, that's, like I said, the camel's nose under the tent. I mean, once you interject government into this, even if you have a benign purpose initially, you know, it's never going to stay, because, you know, power corrupts. And as soon as you create this agency, it now has a life of its own and it thrives, and it just has to get bigger and bigger and bigger and do more and more and more. You know, government grows like a cancer. You know, it's not like in the free market, you have, you want to be efficient as possible. You want to use as few resources as possible because the person is trying to generate a profit. But in government, it's like it's the opposite. You just want to be as big as possible, as inefficient as possible. You want to spend as much as possible. And a lot of times too, when you have government, let's say you have a government agency and, you know, they're there to kind of, you know, help poverty. They're there to fight poverty. Well, what they end up doing is their incentive is to create more poverty, because the last thing they want to do is end poverty, because now they no longer need to, they're no longer needed anymore. You can shut the agency down. When you're in charge of an agency, you want your agency to be bigger. You want more power. So what you want is more poverty. So that's exactly what government anti-poverty programs end up doing, is perpetuating poverty to trap more and more people into poverty. So now you can justify a bigger agency, the bigger department, which, of course, and it benefits government, because as people are trapped in poverty, you can always count on them to vote for you if they think you're the only way out of poverty. It's right. You cripple people and you convince them that the only way they can get a crutch is from the government. Right. And so that's why, you know, these programs get started as programs from 50 years ago, 75 years ago, New Deal programs that, you know, that we started in the Depression that are still around.
And that's the point. They need to be held accountable. But the point is not necessarily to simply throw them out. That's throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
No, there is no baby. It's all
but that's water. I think that's the point. That gets to the core of what you believe and how you feel about these things. And again, you know, that's what we're really dealing with. That's the conclusion of Descartes'
error.
Yeah,
and even if there was a baby to begin with, the baby is so small compared to the bathwater that, look, whatever problem government was trying to solve, let's just live with that problem. Because if we try to solve it with government, it's just going to be so much bigger. It's just no way to say, yes, let's make government work and let's make it be efficient, because it's like it just can't happen.
Well, but that's the same thing. I mean, that's taken to the extreme, that's where the anarcho-capitalists end up. They're like, look, the police abuse their authority. They harass and brutalize people. So let's just do away with the police.
Yeah, I mean, that's the argument that they make. And, you know, I've always tried to make an argument. Look, you know, I believe that anarchy isn't going to exist. I think that if we don't have a government, one is going to come into existence at some point. So let's just preempt that by creating one of limited power. And that's what the Founding Fathers attempted to do with the Constitution, is, okay, we're going to have this government, but we're going to make it a very limited power. And, you know, to the extent that we can have a very small government and keep it small, but that is the problem. But the way to keep it small is it has to start out with as few powers as possible. But anything that it gets, it's going to immediately try to usurp more. It's going to try to, you know, push that envelope and just get bigger. And so you have to be very, very vigilant to keep small government small. And America was successful for a long time, and that's why we prospered. But, you know, we couldn't keep the genie in the bottle forever. That was a problem, you know.
Well, I think that's the thing. Since you've brought up the Founding Fathers and I've brought up the Founding Fathers, it might be helpful to remember what they said in Federalist 51. And so I'm just going to share a little quote here. But what is government itself but the greatest of all reflections on human nature? If men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary. In framing a government which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next, place oblige it to control itself. A dependence on the people is no doubt the primary control on the government, but experience has taught mankind the necessity of auxiliary precautions. So to me, that is, I think the Founding Fathers were right, is that the reality of the world and is that anything you do, any action is going to generate a reaction. And, you know, it's you're not fundamentally trying to, there's no perfect solution, but you're trying to counteract, and that's why you have the FDA. But of course, the FDA left to its own devices will grow beyond its bounds, and therefore it has to be checked. But to me, the real breakdown in our society is the fault lies not in our government, but in ourselves. It's that we're not fundamentally well enough informed to be able to be discerning to recognize, okay, what is baby and what is bathwater and what should we throw out and what should we keep? And
yeah, and that's, again, that's the inherent flaw in democracy is that, you know.
That's an inherent flaw in a democracy where the people aren't educated. And, the you know, as.
No, education is, look, I mean, look, you have all these educated people that are extremely liberal. I mean, you know, you can have lots of degrees and not know anything about economics. I mean, it's not the education because you got plenty of, you know.
But that's
people.
People have
advanced degrees that are very liberal. I mean, look, you have people with, you know, geniuses that have been very, very liberal. They don't necessarily think about that. You know,
but they're not fundamentally educated. I went to Harvard, so I know these people, and I know what a fancy degree does, and I know what the education you get, and you learn how to rationalize a particular worldview in a very complex way. But that doesn't mean that you're wise, and I think that's the point, is that we have a lot of smart people who can quote a lot of statistics and rationalize their arguments. We don't have a lot of the sort of wise people who actually founded this country. And that has nothing to do with the degree, and that's not a real education.
I know. I mean, and you look at, too, you look at how small a population we had and look at how wise the people that we had during that time relative to the fact that we're drawing on a population 100 times larger, and we probably don't have anybody as wise as them in Washington today.
No, and I think generally in the country. I mean, I think that's the challenge is that, you know, our educational system failed us. It crammed our heads full of facts, and it didn't really teach us how to think.
And that's because we turned over education to government. We made it a government thing. I mean, and there's nothing in the Constitution about education. The word education is not there. The word school is not there. You know, the framers did not think that the government would be involved in education. And, you know, but now they are, unfortunately. But, you know, I would much rather see private enterprise competing to educate our children than government monopolies that operate for the benefit of the teachers' unions. And, you know, no one gives a damn about the kids.
Well, Peter, there, and this is where culture comes in because there are larger forces at work here. And obviously, you feel that the government is the source of all of our problems. But I can tell you a totally different narrative, which comes down to what we believe about human potential. And, you know, in 1776, you know, there David McCulloch has this great line in his Pulitzer Prize winning book that it was a day and age that saw no reason why man could not, by serious and diligent application to books, teach himself whatever was required. And that was the spirit of the time. That's the spirit of 76.
And now, you know, with the internet, people can learn a lot more. I mean,
100%. But they don't.
But you know, I'm not just blaming the government too. You know, I'm not letting the Federal Reserve off the hook.
That's fine. But there's also fundamental faith in intelligence and a willing to challenge what you believe. And that's you know the spirit of a people who are founding a nation is that they're looking for holes and flaws in their own thinking. And you know, we are trust fund kids. We've inherited this great country, and the majority of us just take it for granted that it's always going to be around, and we don't take the time to find the faults in our own thinking, and we just sit in our echo chambers and we rationalize our own thoughts, whatever they may be, liberal, conservative, or libertarian. And, you know, we don't fundamentally improve our thinking and we just, you know, feel self-righteous.
Yep.
So, I mean, I think that's the point is we have this fantastic tool, the internet. And the great thing about this tool, the internet, is that, you know, we can have respectful conversations like this. We can challenge each other's thinking. And fundamentally, we have the opportunity to all become wiser. And that doesn't, you know, until the government starts shutting down the internet, I don't think that the government is the primary obstacle to that being achieved.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that, Peter?
About what?
How do you feel about all that, what I just said, or did you zone out?
Repeat it. I mean, I think I got distracted for a second.
Well, all I'm saying is that, you know, the fundamental obstacle is the ability of, you know, people like you and me who disagree, but who are willing to be respectful and reasonable to have conversations.
Well, what are we exactly disagreeing on?
Well, the point is, I think that, you know, you just, you know, I think that anytime there's any sort of problem, you're... You know, knee-jerk reaction is to blame the government for that.
And well, it depends on the problem. I mean, I'm not like if I walk outside and stub my toe, I'm not going to blame the government for that.
Well, but we're talking about the populace being uneducated, and your first reaction is to say that's the government's problem.
Well, obviously, because look, the government is so involved in education. I mean, so who are you going to blame? I mean, the government has taken over education, right? I mean, there are some private schools out there, but they, you know, the market in education is so corrupted by government. And now it's not just – look at higher education. I mean, do you think it's a coincidence that college degrees are so expensive yet practically worthless? I mean, look what the government did to a college degree, because the government wasn't even involved really in going to college until the GI Bill after the war. Right. And then they started to get more involved. But, you know, prior to government involvement, I mean, very few people went to college. And if you went, it was a big deal. It actually meant something.
And
now
everybody
goes to college and it means nothing.
And that's
and it costs a fortune. I mean, it costs so much more. I mean, let's say if you were in 1910, 1920, you know, if you wanted to send your kid to Harvard or Yale, and he was a bright kid and he really could benefit from that experience, and you were a middle class guy, you can afford it. You could actually, if you didn't even need any loans, you could do it, you know. But, you know, a lot of kids just worked their way through college, and it was not hard. I mean, people could work their way. The best college, you could go to Harvard, you could go to Yale, and you could just have a summer job, and you can earn enough money. You wouldn't even need money from your parents. You can afford to go to the most expensive, best universities we had, and you actually learn something. But, you know, most people didn't go. I mean, back then, you know, a high school diploma was a big deal. Most people didn't even get that. But if you got that, that meant something. Now it means nothing. Everybody gets a high school diploma. Whether you can read or not, you get it. It's a rubber stamp. And then you go to college. You have people in college that can't even read or do mathematics. They have remedial math and English in college. I mean, it's ridiculous. And it costs a fortune. And you have kids now graduating $50,000, $100,000 or more in debt. You think this would happen in a free market? Not a chance. This is all government that's doing this. You know, this is government guaranteed loans and government subsidies and government schools. I mean, you think in a free market somebody can get all the way K through 12 and then go to college and still not be able to do comprehend a basic paragraph or do mathematics, addition? I mean, we got functional illiterates getting through college.
Right, I understand that. I mean,
that would never happen in a free market.
Well, but the ultimate free market is the internet. The point is that the reason why we're doing this podcast is that we're giving for free an education that is better than what you would get at Harvard.
The internet is great, and I think more people will opt out of the school system and just learn online, learn on their own, take advantage of the fact that they can have all the knowledge on their cell phone.
Yeah.
What used to be so important about universities is they had the books. They had these great libraries, and you had access to their libraries. Nobody needs a library. You have everything you want on your smartphone. And people have an opportunity. And if you have a teacher who's a gifted teacher, he doesn't need a university. He could just give a course on the internet, charge a small amount of money, and speak to tens of thousands of people or millions of people at a time.
And that's the great thing. So the government is irrelevant. Like, we don't have to be angry at the government. We can just outcompete it on the internet.
No, yes. I mean, to an extent, yes, there's going to be a way around it. And what has to happen, obviously, too, is, you know, businesses, and of course, they'll recognize that these degrees are worthless, and they won't just exclude people that don't have college degrees. Somebody will come up with better ways of, you know, just accrediting people or just to screen your applicants some other method other than the fact that they were able to spend 6 years getting a 4-year degree. The market is ultimately, because look, kids aren't going to go anymore. I mean, college is now so ridiculously expensive that you can't even argue with a straight face that it's worth the cost.
Of course not. And, you know, I mean, the whole thing that, a lot of what we go on is there. I don't know if you remember Good Will Hunting, but there's that great scene in the Harvard bar where the guy is a dickhead. And, you know, Will says to him, you know, you're going to lose two certainties in life. One, don't do that. And two, you dropped $150,000 on an education you could have gotten for $1.50 in late library fees. And the reality is that I think that's the my point is just that the government is irrelevant. You offer people a better education for far less money or no money. I mean, that's the great thing is that if you serve the people and, you know, you are helpful to them and then you say, hey, do you want a T-shirt? They're like, yeah, I want to buy a T-shirt. So, you know, you don't even have to charge them for the education.
The thing is, though, it's not irrelevant to the extent that they're screwing up society and running up the cost of doing business and creating a lot of problems that wouldn't exist absent all that government. I mean, government is good if it could just stick to the functions that it's supposed to do. But, you know, that's like that was Jefferson, right? It's a necessary evil. But I mean, recognize that it's an evil. But the problem is it's very bad. It's very easy for it to be intolerable rather than necessary. You know, I think we've crossed that boundary a long time ago with respect to our government, right?
But I think the point is that that's because, you know, it's you know, any shopper, whether you're shopping as a voter or as an actual shopper, you need to have enough understanding to not buy a lemon, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's the problem is that, you know, the voters fundamentally aren't well educated enough and don't have enough of a worldview to be able to spot what is good government and what is unhelpful bad government. And so
I mean, I hope one of the things, one of the companies I recently became involved with, which I hope can really help advance this, is this company called Gold Money. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but anybody could just, you know, go to goldmoney.com and set up an account. And basically what it does is enables you to have your own online account, like a bank account, except your deposits are in gold, right? So you can go and take your Visa or MasterCard and buy $100, $1,000 worth of gold. You own the gold. It's your gold. It's stored for you. It's segregated. It's in your name. You own it. But you can now transact with it online, just like you could with dollars or euros or yen. You can buy things with it. You can spend, you know, 10 cents of it, 20, you know, you don't have to spend it all. You can buy a cup of coffee, a pack of cigarettes, or you could buy something more expensive, but you can send it anywhere in the world you want for free. You know, you can, you know, it's like a bank account. You get a debit card, a MasterCard. You can utilize that MasterCard. You can buy stuff, you know, in person online. You can go to an ATM machine and withdraw cash. But as you do, you're just diminishing the amount of gold that you own. So your account is based in gold. But my goal with the company is that if enough people around the world just reject government money, just like people reject the post office and use FedEx or reject the taxi cab and they use Uber, if people can reject dollars and reject euros or yen and just deposit their savings into gold and then use that account to pay their bills, to pay their, you know, to live the life and, you know, transact in gold. You know, everybody used to use gold as money until the governments came up with paper. And paper was more convenient until now. It's actually now cheaper and more convenient for me to send somebody $10 worth of gold, right? If I wanted to send you right now $10 worth of gold, I can do it quicker and faster than sending you $10 of cash.
Well, if you want to send me $10 of gold, I won't object, Peter. You know, you can up the amount. You can send me as much gold as you want. And so, yeah, where should people check out your work is that, you know, to listen to the Peter Schiff Show?
Well, I mean, they should certainly. I do my podcasts on shiftradio.com, also on my YouTube channel, The Schiff Report. So people should go there. You know, visit my website at my brokerage firm, Euro Pacific Capital, europac.com. Sign up for my newsletters. You know, read my book. You know, the Real Crash Out, America's Coming Bankruptcy, How to Save Yourself and Your Country. That is the most recent book. But you can look at all my books and some of my dad's books, too, at shiftbooks.com. So, you know, I'm pretty easy to find online. But I think the most important thing for people to do is to act and protect themselves. I mean, you know, we talked earlier in the show about, you know, the financial crisis. Well, you know, there are people that profited from that, and there are people that lost a lot of money. And I think this next crisis is going to present even bigger opportunities for profit, and even more people are going to lose a lot if they're on the wrong side of this. So to the extent that you're an investor, that you have money to invest, you need to understand these forces and how they're going to play out. And so I would encourage people, you know, to do something. Either get yourself some gold, you know, go to goldmoney.com, open up an account, you know, get out of the banking system, own some gold. But also if you have larger accounts, you have a brokerage account, you're investing, to go talk to my reps at Euro Pacific Capital, at europac.com, to learn about the strategy that I use personally to try to protect myself, and which countries we can invest in, which countries have the most amount of economic freedom, the least aggressive monetary policy. So you have the countries that are closer to what America used to be than what than America is today. You know, we have more liberty, freer trade, surpluses, less government, freer markets. That's where I want to invest.
Perfect. Perfect.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks so much, Peter.
Okay. My pleasure.
All right. Take care. Have a good one. Ladies and gentlemen, that was Peter Schiff, and that was the libertarian worldview. I think that in terms of it's a great example of everything that John Haidt talks about. You know, libertarians have these strong notions of liberty, and that is their big moral intuition. And they interpret the entire world through that, so that ultimately you notice that as we talked to Peter, he just kept on coming back to the idea that the problem was the government, the government, the government, even though there were contradictions where he recognized that the public wasn't fundamentally educated. He recognized that the internet enabled us to move ideas, and that, you know, very often, there were just a lot of things that I'm sure made internal sense to him, made internal sense to the libertarians who recommended to have him on. But for a mixed mental artist, it wasn't a particularly satisfying conversation. There were things we could agree on, and then there were things that he just, you know, again, he's well aware that people on Wall Street endlessly rationalize their own feelings. And I would say that a lot of that was him doing the same thing. So there you go. You know, but again, we welcome him. We thank him for coming into the dojo. And, you know, if he feels that my comments were unfair and he wants to read the work of John Haidt and discuss that, or if he wants to read the work of Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky, or the work of, the Damasios at USC about how humans actually think, and then come back and have a discussion about how my brain works, how his brain works, and how the brains of people on Wall Street works, he is always welcome to do so. We love people challenging our thinking because that's how we all get wiser.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.